The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great, and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerkers Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome to the live edition of the Modern Wrong World Made Right. And Calvin Was Wrong, Volume 2, Episode 8. Here on the Crusade Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be. And we've been on a three-week hiatus because of varying traveling schedules and other back-to-school assorted matters. But we are now back and ready to continue with the second volume of the work of St. Robert Bellarmine on the controversy over the Roman Pontiff that we began with Volume 1 and Volume 2 and are now on Volume 3 called Antichrist. And available in my bookstore in the Founders Trading Post at mikechurch.com/shop and at the bookstore of our expert Latinist translationist, Ryan Grant at Mediatrix Press. That's MediatrixPress.com, where you will find all of other Ryan's works, whether translated or just brought back into print. Plus his historical restoration projects, they are all there on the MediatrixPress.com site. So we will get right into the action here today and pick up where we left off, which was on chapter number 14 in our previous discussions here. We had made it all the way through chapter 13 of the Antichrist book. And on chapter 14, it is on the doctrine of Antichrist, but this conversation takes place on a special day, since today is the feast day of All Saints, and we'll be reading and talking about the work of Saint Robert Bellarmine. We can bring our resident expert on Saint Robert Bellarmine, Ryan Grant, onto the show, and welcome Ryan back. And Ryan is fresh off of giving a 2-day conference, I believe, on St. Robert Bellarmine in Colorado, right?
That's correct. Well, it was in one day, but it was two separate conferences.
Okay. Well, I saw part one and part two, so I guess you took a break for lunch.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
No, not really. Just to sell some books.
Just to sell some books. How does on All Saints Day today?
We also had one of your...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we also had listeners in the audience, too.
Yeah, I was told by Steve Cunningham that there was at least one there that was in attendance. So that's always great to hear. Today is All Saints Day, obviously, on the Catholic calendar, one of the biggest days of the year. As a matter of fact, a day that J.J. Ollier, who is the founder of the Society of Saint Sulpice, am I saying that right, Saint, or is it Saint Sulpice?
I believe it's Saint Sulpice, but I'm not a French expert. So.
Okay, Sulpice. The Feast of All Saints seems to me to be in some sort a greater than that of Easter or the Ascension. Our Lord is perfected in this mystery because as our head, he is only perfectly fulfilled when he is united to all his members, the saints. The feast is glorious because it manifests exteriorly the hidden life of Jesus Christ. The greatness and perfection of the saints is entirely the work of his spirit dwelling in them. It's quite a beautiful little paragraph there to kick off All Saints Day and a discussion of one of the most important saints in all of the 16th century, I would say, and that is the life of the work, I would say, of St. Robert Bellarmine. And how long was it before Bellarmine was canonized, Ryan, after his death?
Well, that's an interesting subject, actually. Of course, you can find it in my talk. I spoke about it, but it was actually about 300 years. It was an extremely long time.
And was there something that was hung up in the miracle verification process or something?
No, all of that was in order right away. But there was a concerted effort. See, part of the problem is, and I go into this a little bit in my talk, Bellarmine's writings on the papacy, we spoke about that here before, they were too, you know, it was too minimal for Pope Sixtus V, so he wanted them put on the index, which very nearly happened. It was actually printed on the index, but it wasn't promulgated because of his teaching in Book 5 on the indirect power of the papacy. That is, that the Pope is not Lord of the world, he does not have full temporal jurisdiction over all the kings of the earth, but Bellarmine says, basing himself squarely on the fathers and on the saints, especially St. Thomas, the Pope has indirect power over the kings of the, you know, over the nations of the earth for the sake of the faith. And so part of that is understanding the nature of church and state. And people act like that doesn't function today. Well, that was just by the common consent of Christendom, which ain't there anymore, so it's not there. But that's not true at all, because the basis of it is not the consent of Christendom. The basis for this power is the very nature of church and state, that both are societies embracing their members, but the church is the more perfect of the two. So things that overlap between the two, namely the public regulation of religion, the church is over the state.
Correct.
So when you go and say, such as, well, I'm not going to get in the debate about what Vatican II really says, but at least those who defend what they view as the opinion that there is this separation of church and state in the absolute sense meant, say, by a Jefferson or someone, that you can't have, or before him, Hobbes and Locke and others,
right?
You can't have, they're merely on equal footing, you know, nothing to do with the other, that's metaphysically impossible. You cannot have that state of affairs. And that's essentially what Bellarmine is saying in Book 5. Now, a bunch of canonists really didn't like that, and so they got Sixtus V, who was also a canonist, to condemn that proposition in Bellarmine, but that it was never promulgated. Then the next pope comes in, Urban the 11th. No. Urban VII, I'm sorry, and he comes and he gets rid of, he fixes that whole situation right away, takes him right off the very strange company he found himself. So then, in France, on the other hand, almost within a few years of that, Bellarmine's position on the indirect power was swiftly condemned by those influenced by Gallicanist opinion. And part of it is kind of the aftermath of the wars of religion in France, which brought Henri Bourbon to the throne. And now everyone pretty much gave in to divine right of kings, because that was the only way it seemed to save the situation in France. Because during the wars of religion, and when Henri III died, or was assassinated by this crazy crazy Franciscan, I can't remember what his name was, then so he's dead, there's no heir to the throne, so the king of Navarre, Henri Bourbon, becomes the king. And so then the Catholic League, which had been fighting the Calvinist in France since the fourth war of religion, is now, you know, up in arms, and they become the biggest Democrats and anarchists, and we can't possibly allow this to ever happen. Then the other side, the Calvinists, they who traditionally been of the very same mind, now all of a sudden they're supporting divine right of kings when it's their guy, Henri Bourbon, that is going to become the king. So in the end, I mean, Bellarmine was actually in Paris when Bourbon, you know, put a siege on it as part of the legation of Pope Sixtus V to Paris. But then, you know, the Catholic League as well as the Spanish came down, and Bourbon had to lift the siege. And so then the Catholic League was working to try to get some of their heir, even put a Spanish heir on the throne or something, which wasn't very popular. And then Bourbon pulled the rug right out of their right out from under them by converting back to the faith. And so he famously said, Priez la vie de la masse, something of that sort. Paris is worth a mass. And so I probably butchered the French in that, but that's what he said, and he became Catholic, and that kind of solved the problem. Then everyone gets behind divine right of kings. Now, Bellarmine's argumentation is completely against it. So his political philosophy is basically for the king is himself a servant. Yes, ultimately all government, all legitimate government has its authority from God, but it's not above the power of the church in matters pertaining to a religion. So he also talks about this in Book 4 and Book 5, that if there's a contradictory law, you know, between, say, secular states and the Pope, and if, you know, pontifical laws hold sway in matters of religion, but not in any secular affair, right?
Right, right.
Well, in France, the Gallicans hated this, especially the Gallican Church was coming around this time, and it also comes together with Jansenism, mm-hmm. and a lot of them make common cause. So long after these debates, Bellarmine departs in 1621, Jansenism doesn't really get underway for another 20 years or so. But Gallicanism's already in full swing, right? The whole idea of trying to say that the council's above the Pope, and we, the Church of France, Henry VIII style, is above whatever the Pope might decree. The Pope's just a bishop anyway, you know. Right. So that's the attitude of Gallicanism. So Bellarmine's writings were seen as very hateful to them. You know, they took Bellarmine as the personal enemy, the Gallicanists did. Even though Bellarmine remained very popular in France, and most French theologians read Bellarmine very well and defended his propositions. But nevertheless, the Gallicans had the support of the monarchy after Henri Bourbon did not. He didn't mm-hmm. support the Gallican position because he recognized that he owed a lot of his position to the Pope. And he was also very good friends with Cardinal Baronius, who's a friend of Bellarmine. So he, you know, he was always very dutiful to the Pope. But on the other hand, then he dies. He's assassinated also by a crazy man named Ravillac, or I can't remember how it's pronounced. And then you get Louis XIII, whose minister of state during his regency is Richelieu, Cardinal Richelieu. Yeah, and so that history starts to come into vogue. And Richelieu promoted the Gallicans. He was always about promoting the interest of France over and above those of Europe or the church, which he does during the 30 Years' War and other things. So the nature of things in France, you know, is that the crown from that point on, all the way through Louis XV, formally favors the Gallican position. They won't push it that much, but they will push it just a bit. And so Bellarmine's canonization was that thing that just every time it came around, you just had the Gallicans would just throw, you know, fits about it. And then, the threat of schism was such that and dangerous, especially Louis XIV had already threatened the Pope several times in the 1680s. So they kind of tabled it. In 1677, the Devil's Advocate produced St. Robert Bellarmine's autobiography, then in manuscript, and try to tax certain elements of it with a species of vainglory. And then so those promoting the cause looked at it and they said, no, there's nothing, no problems here. And then he was so convinced by it that he declared that, well, that was just my job as devil's advocate. And I absolutely agree with what they've said, that there's nothing wrong with these statements. So then we come around again to 1750. And the Pope is Pope Benedict XIV. He's one of the most learned theologians to ever be Pope, Prosper Labrantini in life. Mm-hmm. And Benedict XIV had written in his book on the beatifications and canonizations of the saints, praising Bellarmine's life as a holy life and as an example of someone who should be canonized. And he had been a devil's advocate who in the 1721 process.
Right.
So Benedict XIV in 1753, he's all ready to canonize Bellarmine. But then there's a couple of problems. There's three cardinals. One of them is actually the Cardinal Duke of York, the brother of Bonnie Prince Charlie, and the son of James III. Ironically, great-grandson of James I,
okay.
Who Bellarmine sparred with in print And although that reason doesn't seem to have come in with it, it was more of the company he was keeping. And, of course, his ties to France, because the French were supporting his family for a very long time. And then the ringleader was Cardinal Passanet. Passanet took the autobiography and made the same claims that it is full of vainglory and pride and all these things, and he can't be a saint. But the real reason was he was absolutely anti-Jesuit. And he absolutely supported, you know, those early efforts to suppress the Jesuits done in the 1740s, as it would, was, it wouldn't happen until the 1780s, but, or 17s late, yeah, about 1780s or so. So 1781, I'm actually fuzzy on that date of the Jesuit suppression, so it might have even been a little earlier, but anyway, so Passanet absolutely hated the Jesuits. And so he saw Bellarmine's canonization as a terrible thing because he didn't like Jesuits. So he mustered all of his support, and of course all of his support in France, which included getting the Gallicans and the Jansenists stirred up, and then even the court of France itself, then under Louis XV, threatened schism if Bellarmine would be canonized. So they had to leave it alone again. Benedict XIV reluctantly had to abandon the cause because of the pressure the French court was putting on the Pope. So then in the 19th century comes around again, and they're really pushing it, of course, after the revolution and everything. Pius IX was very much in favor of it. So, and of course, what happens is Vatican I gets into swing. And at Vatican I, you have all of the, the Gallicans have long since been extinguished because you had the French Revolution. You had basically the de facto creation of a Gallican church, but in the form of the French Patriotic Church, right, which was a creature of the state trying to advance the God of Reason and all this other business. And a lot of people saw through it who had initially been in favor of it. But so that, you know, so the whole spirit of Gallicanism had been extinguished by the French Revolution because everyone had a taste of schism. And nobody liked it. So even when Napoleon had the Pope in jail and offered basically to the French bishops, here you go, you've wanted Gallicanism for all these years, now you've got it. And they said, well, actually, no, we don't. We don't want it. We don't want it. We swear. And, you know, it's a one of those funny turns of history. But once you get to Vatican I, all of a sudden everyone's all the liberals are agitating again this whole question of Pope versus Council, as much as the Gallicans ever did, that a council's above the Pope. And you have people like Duhlinger, who's really, you know, ahead of this. And of course, almost all theologians hold to what Bellarmine teaches and what now is a formal doctrine of the church since Vatican I. But it was already a doctrine of the church. It was already universally held, minus, you know, a handful of theologians here and there. So followers of Duhlinger, or even the historian von Heffeli, who did submit to the church's decision, unlike Duhlinger, they started arguing, and Lord Acton as well in England, he's another one, who died, of course, still denying papal infallibility at the end, died a heretic. But Acton, along with Duhlinger and these other people, were absolutely enraged that there was going to be an ecumenical council called by the Pope, and they wanted to urge the abandonment of course, Bellarmine's teaching. And so they make a big hissy fit about this, and it goes into the international press. Now, in the draft documents of Vatican I, there were no plans to talk about papal infallibility. So when you read various historians that are not Catholic, that have not done the research, they'll just kind of dismiss Vatican I and say, oh, it's the Church's ridiculous response to the modern world, right? It was never meant to be a response to the modern world. It was meant to be a response to Catholics who, in the international press, were now denying this doctrine. Okay. Which everybody held.
Got it.
So Bellarmine kind of became just as important at Vatican I as St. Thomas Aquinas had been at Trent. So that all the debates on anything dealing with in the Constitution Pastor Eternos had to do with basically Bellarmine. He was the root of almost all discussions. Even the question, okay, well, let's start looking at these popes who erred. Once again, Bellarmine's listing in Book 4, Chapters 8 through 13, or 14, sorry. Those are the basis for the entire discussion at Vatican I. Even if they didn't all agree with Bellarmine's conclusions, they all agreed that none of these popes erred in faith. So, so Bellarmine basically ran at everything. So again, you know, it's like at that point, 250 years since Bellarmine's death, and everything is still turning on his theology, even at that point.
That's amazing.
And of course, people like Duhlinger and Acton, you know, for them, Bellarmine was their enemy. That's how they took it, right? So Pius IX had this grand plan at Vatican I to make a catechism for the universal church based on Bellarmine's catechism, and then to crown the work by canonizing Bellarmine. But he was stopped by the Freemasonic Revolution that shook Italy and took the Papal States away from the Pope and put in the Duke of Savoy. And in amongst with various other problems that happened. So Pius IX became prisoner of the Vatican. The Kulturkampf happened in Germany. The church is being attacked almost on all sides. And so, that had to be abandoned. And that's why it took until about 1923, they were finally able to get his beatification. Then 1930, his canonization and declaration as a doctor of the church.
My goodness. Well, I guess this is going to have to be a two-parter then. So we'll move on to part two now and to Antichrist chapter. I told you inerrantly, we had left off, we had finished chapter 13 last time, and we were going to start on chapter 14, which is on the doctrine of Antichrist, right?
Oh, boy. Well, it's a good thing I read ahead last night.
Well, I'm sure you read when you were translating.
I did, but that was about a year ago.
Oh,
I did that section. So, but nevertheless.
So we start this on the doctrine of Antichrist. And just to reset this for those of you that may be listening for the first time or just getting into the series and hearing about it for the first time and this preview, that the controversy over the Roman pontiff, which Ryan and I began again with volume one of Bellarmine's, St. Robert Bellarmine's work on that, and continued with volume two, and into volume three now with Antichrist, that the current or the recurring theme that runs through all of our discussions here is that at the time, of course, he's not St. Robert Bellarmine, he's just Cardinal Bellarmine or Bishop Bellarmine at the time, answers all of the charges point by point by point down to the sentence of all of the Protestant, quote, reformers, close quote, including Illyricus, including Calvin, John Calvin, which is why we named the series John Calvin Was Wrong or Calvin Was Wrong, including Martin Luther, and there are several others. And as we find, although Bellarmine could have made very strong theological arguments against these claims of the illegitimacy or the non-existence of the infallibility of the Pope, instead, Bellarmine just used the historical record, for the most part, against the Protestant reformers, and at every turn, and sometimes would even invoke great humor, in destroying their arguments from the facts of the matter. He didn't even have to really get into a theological debate or discourse over this. It was just that they had all their facts wrong. And I would say that that error pretty much continues all the way up into it today. And thus, that leaves us at chapter number 14 now in the Antichrist book on the doctrine of Antichrist. So, does Antichrist have a doctrine?